Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 909. This episode is brought to you by Tor Books, the proud publishers of Anonymous by Annalee Newitz, described by Neal Stephenson as being to biotech and AI what Neuromancer was to the internet, and also praised by William Gibson as genuinely thrillingly new. Autonomous explores a fundamental question: is freedom possible in a culture where everything can be owned? So a little bit of the story. Earth 2144, Jack, an anti-patent scientist turned drug pirate, traverses the world in a submarine fabricating cheap drugs for poor people who can't otherwise afford them, but her latest hack has left a trail of lethal overdoses and people becoming addicted to their work, doing repetitive tasks until they go insane or die. So that's just a taste. Don't miss Autonomous, the highly anticipated science fiction debut from the founder of IO9, available now wherever books are sold. Do you have anything for the Nerdist Community Corkboard?
I do. I have a couple things.
Well, let's corkboard it up.
So this first one is one that is from me, and it's just about the fires that are happening in Northern California right now.
Sure.
Very close to my hometown, Santa Rosa, Sonoma, Napa. They're really close to where I grew up. I spend a lot of time there. I have friends, family there, and it's so beautiful up there, and I really love it. But right now, they are all on fire. More than 100,000 acres are burning. Entire neighborhoods, stores, farms, wineries have been burned to the ground, and the fire are still growing and barely contained. Officials are up there in need of donations and supplies for the people who have lost their homes and have been evacuated, because thousands of people had to be evacuated.
Right.
And there are donation sites in Petaluma, Marin, San Francisco, and across the bay. You can find organizations and donation sites at, and I made tiny URLs for this, tinyurl.com/firehelp1 and tinyurl.com/firehelp2. And those just take you to like the ABC 7, the local stations up there. Also, animal shelters up there have taken in a lot of displaced pets and are in need of donations and fosters. So if you are able to help out, please contact Marin Humane Society, Milo Foundation, Rocket Dog Rescue, Sonoma Humane Society, Napa County Animal Shelter, Petaluma Animal Shelter, and if you have large animals, because there's a lot of ranches and farms,
sure.
You can take those animals to the Sonoma County Fairgrounds where they have holding for them now.
Excellent.
And then one more thing. This is kind of fun. So, you know, the mountain lion that lives in the Hollywood Hills here, P-22.
Is that his official name?
That's his official name. Well, in celebration of Urban Wildlife Week, L.A. has made October 22nd P-22 Day. So in Griffith Park, they're going to have a kind of like a festival on October 22nd from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. There's going to be live music, food. They'll have like a cutout.
Is P-22 headlining? Is he going to DJ?
I hope so. That'd be great. I look for him every time I hike up in Griffith Park. I'm like, maybe I'll see my friend.
Are you just
going to
have like the headphones on? Yeah.
They'll have a cardboard cutout of him you can take a picture with.
I got P-22 on Tinder. It was awesome.
But it sounds super great. You can find more info at urbanwildlifeweek.org. And definitely check that out if you live in LA. It's going to be fun.
Fantastic. I mean, I guess, does the mountain lion show up? He's probably not going to show
up. He's not going to. I know some people would have seen him. I wish I have seen him. I look for him.
But I feel it's like,
he's chill. He's just like hanging out.
Like, it's almost like saying like Bill Murray's in the area. Like, oh, you may see him, you may not see him.
Well, my favorite was, remember like a while ago, like a few years ago, he was like in the crawl space under someone's house up in Los Feliz, and like someone was getting work done and this worker went under there and they saw him and they were trying to get him out and they were like, just going about it all the wrong way. Because if you've ever had a cat and he's sleeping, you just leave him the fuck alone and
right.
He'll leave. And they were like trying to actively get him out. And I was like, none of you guys have ever had a cat. Like,
no.
Just go away and he will leave.
A cat will go into another location when it feels compelled.
Yes.
Sometimes
yes.
Slowly, sometimes immediately.
Yeah.
But it'll
happen.
But
if
happen.
You harass it, he's definitely not going to move.
He's definitely
gonna stay
not
there
gonna,
just to spite you.
Yeah, because he's just trying to piss you off.
Yeah.
He's thinking, fuck you.
I remember watching the news being like, none of you have had cats.
You can't tell me what to do. I'm a fucking mountain lion. So wait, is that yarn? Okay, because if you're bringing yarn into the equation,
you probably would like
it's totally
yarn.
Separate, but like a massive ball of yarn.
Like the biggest ones on the side of the room.
Yeah, huge, huge, huge ball of yarn. I also want to promote that at the end of October, I'll be at the American Comedy Company in San Diego for 4 shows. And November 8 through 10, I will be at Caroline's in New York for New York Comedy Festival. So
awesome.
If you go to Caroline's website, you can get tickets there, or American Comedy Company for San Diego. So get all that. And I think I'm actually going to Portland in December, maybe Helium in Portland in December. So those are some upcoming stand-up dates. Please join me. I literally can't do stand-up without you. This episode is Jason Blum, who is the founder of Blumhouse, which has made more movies that you probably love than maybe you realize. Most recently, Get Out.
Yes,
they produce and distributed Get Out, and my wife Lydia and I watch a ton of horror, and so we watch Blumhouse movies all the time. And so I thought, I got to have that guy on the podcast because he's been doing, he created this model a long time ago. It was very forward-thinking, very unique thing that he's created. He really recognized horror as a real genre and has generated some incredible masterpieces in the modern horror landscape. So I got to have that guy on. I heard he has a mobile office and he kind of travels around through all the different things because he's so busy. And I also like having other busy workaholics on because I just like to see, like,
you can relate to them.
I can relate to them.
See how they do it too.
See how they do it too. And I have to say, he was fucking awesome. The second he came in, we just bonded. He's just a fucking great guy. Also, when you meet successful people, you go, okay, I get it. This was not an accident. You have created all this. I mean, I just have so much respect for people who have a vision and they stick to it and they work and they make their thing. And, you could do that. Use that as an example out there if you're on the fence about trying to figure out how to do something. Look at someone like Jason. Be inspired. Go make your own thing. Carve your own path. He carved his own path in a time where it was not common what he ended up doing. So Happy Death Day is the next Blumhouse movie. Lydia and I saw it. It's fucking great. It's like Murder Groundhog Day. It's in theaters Friday the 13th.
How perfect.
It just couldn't be more perfect. And so, and this is really great. Jonah showed up for this one
because Jonah's
also
here.
A horror fan. And so it's almost, it's one sister wife showed up and it was really fun. And there were some phenomenal and interesting developments throughout the course of this podcast, which I'm not going to spoil, but you will hear them and you will hear more about them in the near future. So there you go. Here's the Nerdist podcast number 909. With Jason Blum of Blumhouse. Katie, roll the thing. How long do I do this for?
Keep going.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Everyone in my life who's much younger and cooler and hipper than me is like my brother. It's like, oh my fucking, all of everything I've done, New York Times, everything else, no one gives a shit. But you, my friend, I mean all my assistants, like everyone.
I am so glad to hear that.
It is, you are wildly relevant in this world.
I appreciate that because I, pretty much all my wife and I watch are horror. That's all we watch. Yeah. And my wife is kind of the she's kind of the ambassador for Scream Fest in LA, and she collects horror movie props. And she was in South of Hell,
which
produced.
That's right. Yes, exactly.
And so,
That's right.
Sometimes I forget. Because now when I started the podcast, I would just ask friends to do it, and then I hired Deb to book it. And sometimes I forget I can just ask people to do the podcast because she just pitches. She goes, oh, this person.
Can I be so bold as to offer you a tiny bit of advice?
Please.
Wherever you guys are aiming, aim way higher. I mean, I would go Obama because believe me, his kids – has he already been on?
He's not been on, no.
Because his kids would be so thrilled for him to be on.
Al Gore was on a few weeks ago.
Al Gore's pretty good. Obama's next.
Tom Hanks a couple times.
That's like America's president.
How about I would say Obama and the Pope.
The Pope. Maybe the other one.
The Pope. I like the Pope.
I'm going to go bigger and say Tom Hanks is humanity's president.
Humanity's president?
Yeah, if humanity had a president, it would be Tom Hanks.
It would be Tom Hanks, I think. I'm looking forward to hearing that. How did he do?
He was amazing.
Was he good?
Yeah. He was as Tom Hanksy as you'd want him to be.
Oh, good.
Yeah, he was great.
I have an interesting Tom Hanks story. So we
optioned this book a long time ago called Stoner, mm-hmm. which is a novel by John Williams. And it's an amazing novel, and it's basically an impossible movie. The book was an – it's an impossible movie to make, but I loved it, and we've held on to it for 8 years. And finally, this incredible writer named Andrew Bevel wrote an adaptation, which actually works as a terrific movie, and we're putting it together now. Tom Hanks always loved this book. And we approached him – the story doesn't really have an end except it's my only Tom Hanks story. And we approached him to do Stoner with us many times over the years. And he never did it, but he was always very, very kind and very polite. And I'm looking forward to finally showing him this this movie of what he says is his favorite book.
Wow. Can I give you some advice?
Please.
Send him an old typewriter. That's how we got him on the podcast.
Yeah.
We sent
true?
Him an old – he collects old-timey typewriters.
And you sent him an old typewriter?
We sent him an old-timey typewriter.
Was it a special one? Where'd you find it?
It was just a – I mean, it was just something that it was found on the internet. Just
right.
like a really cool old
– wow.
Yeah. His office at Corona just has a wall of it's like a wall of half records, half typewriters.
So, I mean, I should have sent that with the script.
Well, yeah. This was the most Tom Hanksy response, is that we sent him the typewriter and I sent him a note and said, "Hey, would you please come on the podcast? Here's a typewriter." And his response was typed on the typewriter.
Oh my God.
And at first he was like, "How dare you think you can bribe me with this amazing." Yeah. You know, then he was like, right, damn you to hell.
Avoid the action on this thing.
It was like, that was the most Tom Hanksy response.
Yeah. Amazing.
But then, of course,
amazing.
When we told that story publicly, then I'm sure the poor guy was, you know, like, I'm sure a truck backed up and buried him in typewriters for people wanting him to
He's
do
in
shit.
That documentary that's out right now, American Typewriter.
Oh, he is?
Oh,
yeah,
is he
yeah.
in that?
Yeah, he's got, have you ever used the Hanks Writer app? He has an app in the App Store that is an old-timey typewriter app called
kidding.
Hanks Writer.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, that'll turn your keyboard into an old-timey
What's
typewriter.
What's the fascination with, did he say? What is the,
I mean, I don't know. He just, no, he, just yeah, it's just like,
he likes old-timey stuff. Like, he likes, you know, like, just, I mean, if you think about, like, that thing you do, he likes that era of, like, you know,
for
like,
sure.
stuff and records and music.
Sure.
Yeah.
Very cool.
And there's a really cool artistry to old typewriters. They're really, you know, in a pre-electronic era, they were, you know, mechanisms, like really cool mechanisms.
There's one guy left in New York who I'm sure, by the way, Tom knows him.
I'm sure.
One guy in New York, he's right off Union Square, and I don't collect old typewriters, but I have one, and it's never worked, and I've always wanted it to work. About a couple of years ago, I took it to this store. It was the only store. It's on the fifth floor, and he's like the expert, the last expert in New York City of old typewriters, this guy. They're all over the place. Well, I'm sure they're friends. There can't be too many.
I'm telling you, the next time you want Tom Hanks to do a script, have someone type it out on an old-timey typewriter and send it to him, and I'll bet you he might actually
Joe Wright is directing it, so I'm going to tell Joe. I'm going to tell Joe and Andrew. Maybe they should retype the script and try again.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how they used to have to do copies anyway. Yeah. You know, someone redo it.
Send it to him, you know, just like a couple of little liquid paper with that weird smudge where you type over the liquid paper.
Liquid paper where you keep hitting the key.
Where you keep hitting it and it just looks like someone stepped on a cake.
Yeah.
It's like right in the middle there.
Or just mess it up completely and get them like a word processor from the mid-80s and go, "I heard you like typey things. Here you go."
Ooh, that's not the right era.
Then he'll never talk to me again.
Oh, 1880s.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I really fucked that up.
An 1880s word processor is just a guy that knows a lot of words.
That's all it is. Yeah, it's just a guy. But I'm so glad to have you on because you really I mean, it's rare that I ever have to do this, but I actually saved a list of everything that you've been involved with.
Oh, God, it's
a lot.
It's going to give me a headache.
But I'm so fascinated by what you've built and your process and what made you in, you know, around the year 2000 say, "Hey, I think there's really a market for genre-based micro-budget films."
Yeah,
when the rest of the industry didn't really seem like it was necessarily going that way. And
no,
so what was it? You know, what was it that had, first of all, you're a Los Angeles native, which is a very rare animal.
Oh, thank you.
They're very rare. It's very rarely that you meet people that are not transplants.
No, it's true.
Where did you grow up?
I was born in L.A. I moved to the East Coast, though, when I was 4 years old. So in 1973, I was born here. In 1969, in 1973, moved to New York. I lived in a little town called Hamilton, and then I moved to a bigger little town called Dobbs Ferry, which was in Westchester.
Dobbs Ferry?
And my dad lived in Manhattan, and I went back and forth.
That sounds like the setting of a horror film.
Yeah, that seems like
but
Stephen
King. You know what? Dobbs Ferry really, it was the setting of a horror film. It definitely was. Our house was robbed in Dobbs Ferry. That was kind of a scene from a horror movie, but for sure, yes.
Jeez. Yeah, things aren't the same down in Dobbs Ferry.
They took the the worst thing for a 9-year-old kid.
Video game?
They took my Atari.
Yep. Mm.
And they took my fireworks.
No!
Which were illegal and hidden. That's what they took. Like,
they were chasing the joint.
They were yeah. So it was obviously kids. They took my Atari and my fireworks. And I remember it like it was really yesterday.
That's really
it
fucked
was
up.
Horrible.
Did they take all the games?
The fireworks. Yeah, they took all my cartridges.
No!
They took all my cartridges. They took my Atari. And they took my fireworks, which were illegally bought. I think I got them in Washington, D.C. at the time. Fireworks were, and my cousins lived there. We drove a whole bag of fireworks, which I saved like Halloween candy. Like I'd light one at night because I was a crazy pyromaniac. And they took my fireworks.
God damn it.
They knew, really did you suspect any of your friends or anyone in the neighborhood?
We knew who did it.
Oh, yeah?
We found out who did it. Yeah.
And what'd you
they
do?
Weren't my friends. Well, but they lived literally two blocks away.
Yeah.
And I would drive by their house all the time, and there was we lived in a not great part of town, and it was like low level mob-y. It wasn't really the mafia because that sounds too grand. It is too grand, but it was like low level mob-y kind of thing. And anyway, there was this family, and they were there, and the kids were there, and they'd look at me, and I'd look at them, and we all knew it, but there was nothing we could do because I was worried about getting beat up.
You know what you should do is at the end of all the your Blumhouse card on films just be, where's my Atari, motherfucker? You should put that person's name up there on every one of your films.
Fireworks going off behind it. Yeah.
That's a different person.
Oh, that's a different person.
And his name is Eugene Grace. I hope he's listening. He is the person who picked on me and beat me up to near death in
your
high school.
Literal bully actually stole your Atari.
He didn't sell it. No, I'm saying the person who I would put on the movie.
Oh, I got you. That's the guy.
The guy who stole my fireworks and my Atari. I'm actually, believe it or not, I was 10 years old. I'm over. The guy who beat me up when I was 13, still not over that yet.
You never, this comes up a lot on the podcast, and the more, I almost feel like I'm doing research, but everyone, whenever you are, whatever age you are about when you hit puberty, is sort of whatever the identity that you have as your internal identity for the rest of your life.
So true.
So that kid,
so true.
You're constantly servicing that kid for the rest of your life.
Yes, I am.
And so to hear you say that, you know who your bully is, you know what he did to you.
Yes.
And every time you do something, it's like, fuck you, Grace.
That's right. Yeah. And the answer to your question, that's why I feel I have to do so much. I have to make so many. I can never stop because I'm always trying to make up for it and always trying to get that kid back.
And if you saw that guy, if he's not dead, if you saw that guy, I mean, it's very possible he's not alive anymore. But
he is alive. I have this great one of my closest friends whose name is John Sherman.
Okay.
And John Sherman is a spectacular. He's a great writer, and that's what he does. But he's also really good at deep dives on the internet. And John Sherman found out a lot about Eugene Grace. He's still alive. I went to public school till 8th grade. And then I went to a fancy boarding school, and Eugene Grace III, I think his full name is from a fancy family, and there was lawsuits about the family that John turned up on the internet, which I was so psyched about.
Oh, that's
yes,
awesome.
They're suing each other for money.
By the way, maybe the only bully in history named Eugene.
I know. Yeah. Can you believe that?
He might be.
How about I got beat up by Eugene?
Yeah, like a fancy
lad.
How
bad is that?
Yeah.
The truth is, when I was in high school, and I'm not saying this for effect, and I'm not saying this because it makes a good story, although it does. It is the truth, which is that – and it wasn't so much true my sophomore year. But my freshman year – and there was a specific event that triggered this, which I may or may not get into. But my freshman year, there was like – you know how there's like the really popular kids, and then there's the kids that no one cares about, and then they're like the drama kids, and then there's like kind of the losers who kind of – hang out together and kind of support each other. And then there's one kid who's not even in the loser group.
Yeah.
That was me.
Yeah. Yes,
that was me.
Yeah.
That was me. That
but
was
you know,
me.
I have to say, I was talking about the I was giving a talk at a tech conference and
tech talk?
It was not a tech talk.
Recode?
It was not Recode.
Jesus.
Strike two.
Strike two, for God's sake.
No, I'm not going to tell you. But I was talking about how – now, and I don't mean like hardcore physical bullying where you're afraid to go to school. But I actually kind of weirdly appreciate the social ostracizing that I experienced in grade school because I feel like it forced me to – kind of gain an awareness and be like have an internal monologue and sort of force me to deal with myself. And it really did drive me to want to accomplish things in a weird way.
Yeah.
I'm not saying, if I had a kid, I wouldn't want them to have to go through it.
Right.
But I kind of don't regret that it happened to me because I feel like it it did help stoke some fires that, mm-hmm. you know.
Where'd you go to grade school?
I moved a few times, but initially in Memphis, Tennessee, and then in Denver, and then in Los Angeles.
Public school?
No, I went to private school. Snotty private school. But it was there was something about it that was very motivating, and somehow it never became. I mean, I never feared for my life. I know that, like, you know, like physical bullying and really and what's going on with bullying now is now it's like at least you could escape it when you got home. Now people can just fucking track you down on the internet and continue the bullying. But at the time it was. You know,
Eugene was in the latter category, though, I hate to say.
He would follow you around?
No, the physical. Like, it was It was over the top.
Yeah.
Not to bring us
Have
all
you talked
down.
To him no, since? No. Have you talked to him since? I met one of my bullies. When you go back and you kind of realize how broken these bully kids were and, like, what shit piles their lives were, you can't be upset about it anymore because you go, oh, like, I met – there was one girl who, like, was just brutal. Brutal. And I met her, you know, I met up with her again like 20 years later, and I was expected to be like, you were really fucking mean to me, you know, like I'm still that kid. And she goes, hey, before we hang out, I just want you to know, I was a real bitch in school, and I apologize. It's like my parents were having a rough time, and I was really having a rough time, and I just want you to know that, you know, I'm really sorry about that. And I was like, then. I didn't really have a...
I had three bullies in a private Catholic school I went to, and then I went to public school, and I was safe. I was kind of in like a losers, like
the
off
losers
to
the
sun. Yeah, and like it was
that sophomore year I got into the losers group.
Yeah, and it was like it's like scraps. It's yeah, like yeah, no scraps, one's no one's yeah. really the same.
Yeah,
it's like
yeah,
there's like
yeah.
a skater kid that doesn't hang out with the other skaters. There's a surfer kid.
It's a lambda
gotta,
lambda lambda. Yeah, it's like, yeah. It's all the fluff.
It's the variety pack of weirdos.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but like so I got away from like my bullies, and then but like you know. Like, I went to hang out at my cousin's house, and she's like, oh, I have some friends coming over. And it was all three of my bullies. And they walked in, and they saw me, and they're like, what is he doing here? And it's like, that's my cousin. They're like, what?
Oh.
And then they're like, man, we wouldn't have beat you up if we knew. Your cousin was like, Anna. I go, yeah.
But now that these are the terms of our arrangement, we got to kick the shit out of you.
It was pretty terrible. It's funny. It's hard to talk about them as like bullies because like, what were your bully names? Because it's like, you know, it was like, it's, you know, huge. It's like very, like mine were, it's like they're all like Samoan guys. So it's all a Tui, Toa, and Tupu were my
those
three bullies.
Those are good bully
those
names.
Are great those bullies. Are great bully
yeah.
names.
I mean, that sounds tough.
Well, one time I was talking about it, everyone was talking about old bullies, and they're like, well, you just sound racist. I go, no, it was just the circumstances of living in Hawaii. Like, That's how it was.
Yeah, they just happened to be that, and I just happened to be this.
Yeah, exactly.
I just happened to be a Portuguese guy.
Yeah.
But so this makes me wonder that in the slate of Blumhouse films, do you ever look at a script and are there any characters that sort of remind you of your bullies where you're like, kill that one extra hard, you know? Make sure the Ouija board really rips that guy's soul in half.
No one reminds me of Eugene Grace, but I do think that experience, like you said, definitely shapes the decisions that I made along the way and like trying to prove stuff. And, you know, there's good parts about that and not so good parts about that. Mm. But they definitely, they help make the business successful for sure.
Now you're hoping they're going to your movies and getting scared and embarrassing themselves by screaming in the theater.
It's going to be so funny if Eugene Grace actually reaches out to you after this podcast
God,
and
oh
said,
God.
So you're going to get one of two things. You're either going to get, I am so sorry. You're going to get, yeah. Because if you went around that guy and he was still that way, you would have a difficult time. Like, you would immediately revert to grade school.
I'd want to punch him. I know what he'd say. I think. Well, I have a story for you.
Okay.
So, and I'm gonna try and make it quick. So there was this one thing that happened, which was a really bad thing about 8 weeks into my freshman year, which kind of drove me really out of just into Loserville. And I really hated I hated boarding school. I really hated it. I actually lived my junior year, I lived in France for a year just to get out of it. And I really hated it. I had no contact with my school at all. But when I'm 48 now, when I was in my late 30s, I had this super hot girlfriend and things were going on. And I was the producer of Paranormal Activity and I had a little story in the New York Times Magazine. And I'm like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm going to go back to Taft and I'm going to show these guys who's boss, right? And they're all married, like at 38 or 40. They're all married. You know, they're all with their wives. I'm with my hot girlfriend and we have dinner with them. And I'm looking at these people and it was like going exactly as planned. You know what I mean? Like, I'm feeling feeling great.
The ego is surging.
The ego is surging. Exactly. The ego is surging. And I go to bed. I go to sleep in this hotel and wake up. And the next day, I'm showing my girlfriend, you know, the dorm room where I lived in this place and that place and da-da-da. And this – the group of the four or five hot senior girls starts kind of walking – this way, and I'm friendly with them now. Like it's not it was fine with them. And then one of the guys, who was kind of in the group that he wasn't as bad as Eugene, but his name was George Moore, and there's a story about this. So George Moore comes up the other way, and the girls are here, and George looks at me, and I look at George, and here's Tara, and I'd seen George last night, and George goes, "Remember this thing that happened? It involved X-Lax." He goes, "Remember the X-Lax?"
God.
And he goes, "Remember the X-Lax?" And I was propelled into a time machine to 20 years prior, and the room stopped. And my girlfriend knew the X-Lax story. It was like, I'm not embarrassed about it, but it just was like the way he did it, he just cut me down. And the senior girls were there, and the girl was here, and the world stopped. And I was so intense, and I just felt like I was 13 again and being picked on again. And as soon as the words left George's mouth, to his credit, he realized it was a terrible thing to say, and he felt terrible.
No.
I left the school. I went with Tara. I said, I can't stay. I have to leave. We had to leave. I couldn't finish alumni weekend. Yeah. Like, it was done.
That was it.
George wrote me a series of emails, and then I saw him at an airport later, and he was so apologetic. I almost felt like he felt so badly. But it was an interesting, amazing thing to see how raw that stuff
and
still
you know,
is.
What the great lesson about that Jeez. Is that when you – and I think this just comes with age and wisdom, but when you go after, like, ego pursuits – you can fall so hard because those are the ones where they can be so easily undone and they hurt the most because you're already you're presenting your
you're
ego
exactly right.
as your identity
right you're
and,
exactly
and it,
right
and the carpet can just get ripped out
and my therapist should have said all the time this is an ill-conceived idea. It was a totally stupid thing to do, so I got what I deserved. I think you're right in a way. It's like you can't chase that. It's the wrong thing to do.
It's impossible. At
you're
a certain
100%
point you have
right.
to just go, well, all right, yeah, I guess
exactly.
I, you know,
exactly.
But at least
this you're 100% right.
Could have been so much worse. It could have been so much worse.
It could have been worse, and it was a great. It was a in a way that I could talk about, like you talked about your grade school experience. That experience overall, I'm very happy that it happened because it brought a lot of clarity to the situation, which is a lot of what you're saying is stop trying to prove yourself for those dumb things. It was actually a very kind of. Healing. The whole thing with time was a healing experience.
Right.
And George went over the top so many times and saying you felt so bad that was, you know, it was ultimately a healing experience.
But the truth is, you could be like 85 years old and someone would go, remember the X-Lax story?
I would collapse. I would collapse.
Everything would just
Around. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
But at that point, you might actually just start shitting your pants.
That's true. Yeah, that's
you
true.
You might just start shitting your pants. But what an incredible – I mean, I'm so fascinated by the breadth of what you do that – I mean, what was it around – because I know you'd been producing films for a few years at that point. But they weren't necessarily horror – they weren't horror movies, really. You were
producing
comedy.
No, art house. No, they were art movies that no one saw. I mean, they were – well, that people movies. That was earlier on. I was an executive till I was 30. I worked at a little company called Arrow. Then I worked for Bob and Harvey from 1995 to 2000.
Yep.
I really wanted to have my own company. So I quit and started my own company in 2000, which I definitely quit too early. And I had no idea what I was doing. And all the kind of cliches around doing that were true for me. I was just in way over my head. I produced 7 art house movies, you know, 6 of which nobody saw, one of which was kind of a little bit successful. I was super frustrated. And when Harvey left the Disney company and started the Weinstein company, I was going to go work for him running production. And I was like, I can't be an independent producer anymore. I'm going to go back to work for Harvey. I can't take it. And it fortuitously happened that Brad Grey was at Paramount just started at Paramount at the same time Harvey was doing that. And Brian Lord, who's been kind of a mentor to me, said, you got to go sit down with Brad Grey even though you've never met him. And I met Brad, and Brad made this incredible producing deal for me at Paramount. And I was – which I took because I got to be my own boss,
right.
And I got to have my own company, but I got money, so I didn't have to, you know, drive my own scripts around, which is what I was doing. And And so I went to work at Paramount, and then I'm about to answer your question, and then I really focused on trying to make a big movie. And the first big movie I made was The Tooth Fairy with mm-hmm. Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
Right.
And the experience of making a big movie, any big movie, just wasn't what I had thought. It was just because there's so much money at stake. It's just very political, and it was not what I had hoped it to be. And I had, again, got super lucky that we bumped into Paranormal Activity around the same time that The Tooth Fairy came out. I was in my mid-30s. I'd been working in the business for about 15 years. I'd spent half of that time in independent cinema, half of that time kind of in studio. And Paranormal Activity was like this awesome mix. It was the ultimate independent movie released by the most traditional way, which is a big studio, released by Paramount.
Right.
And I was really lucky that I had kind of had all the experience that I had before Paranormal. I think I don't wish anyone a hit when they're, you know, 25 or younger. I think it's such a – I'm so glad I didn't have Paranormal Activity at 25. There would be no Blumhouse if I did, for sure.
Do you think you would have self-destructed?
I definitely would have self-destructed. Like, Hollywood tells you, if you have a hit, go make an expensive movie. And I'm sure if I had had Paranormal Activity at 25, I would have tried to produce World War Z. And, you know, I might have been a producer, but I wouldn't have had this fun company which is really what I love doing. So anyway, the answer to your question is that lead up and then having Paranormal, it was just, again, it was super, super – I was super fortunate to have that sequence of events happen in that over that time period. And after Paranormal, instead of chasing expensive movies, I said, hey, I think there's a business in independent movies released by studios, in super low budget movies released, made totally off the grid, released in the most traditional way. And really, that's still, you know, our business is really half TV and half movies, but on the movie side, that's still the fundamental model of what we're doing.
Yeah, and horror is a good genre for that because it horror is really, and not, you know, as a horror fan, what you accept about horror is that a small percentage of horror movies are going to be amazing. Mm-hmm. A lot of them are fun, but it's sort of like you sort of trudge through everything because you know when you see an amazing one, it's just, it fucking blows you away.
Right,
Because what makes a really good horror movie is there's a cleverness to it. It's mm-hmm. like, how did they, with not a lot of money, manage to scare the shit out of you? I think, you know, big-time special effects fuck up a horror movie.
Totally agree.
And
totally agree.
And I thought it did a really nice job of sort of balancing what were some practical effects with just a little bit of CG.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. But the CG did in a horror movie, from a, like a horror movie like a stance, like it's like the CG does take you out of like the reality like enough to where it's a little less scary.
Right.
Like it's like practical always kind of like scary.
When they did the reboot of Freddy Krueger, it's like, oh, the original was so much scarier because it was practical.
Yeah,
like
when he's
people
pushing through the thing. Yeah.
But then when they did it in CG, it's like, oh, that's not as scary.
Wouldn't it even be cheaper now to have a guy push through a nylon?
Yeah, right.
Like,
right.
It's probably more expensive to make it look worse.
How hard is that just to get a PA to be like, stick your face in that sheet?
Well, now I totally believe in every bone in my body that that lower budget specifically for horror, it's not true of all genres by any means, but for horror it's just much better. The movies, I always tell them, our directors, no CGI, got to do practical effects and do as little effects as possible, and that makes the movies feel real and more grounded. Mm-hmm. And I think CG in horror movies is just they're immediately not scary.
Right.
Yeah. So yeah, and I was thinking as you were talking, and I get asked a lot, like, why horror, why this, why that, and really, the driving force after Paranormal was this idea of like independent, like how can I call my own shots? You know, one of the things I do with studios always is I always say to them, if we go over budget, it's on me. I'll pay for it if we go over budget, because how can you have a dialogue with your financial partner around a movie and then say, oh, and say, let us be adults. Let us run this. Let us make the decision. Let us run the production. Let us make these decisions. And then if decisions don't work, say, oops, we made a mistake. Now, can we have a check for more money?
Right.
I mean, that drives me bananas. And I really feel like, you know, our relationship with our financiers is much better because we're aligned in that way. And we're aligned in the fact that I also fundamentally believe, and this does not just apply to horror, that movies benefit and the dialogue with your studio partner benefits enormously if your financial interests are aligned. So whether you're making a horror, any kind of movie, and by the way, I'm not, you know, I'm a minority in this thinking, we do it for all our movies, but it's not typical in Hollywood studio movies at all. But I think if you're the director and the producer and the actors and you say, we're only going to make money if the studio makes money, and you really have a deal that says the studio's in profit, you get a big piece of it, I feel like the conversation is much better. How can I sit if you're running X studio and you've paid me $2 million to produce your movie and I have the check in my bank account already, right? And you're going to now spend $150 million on the movie, two of which I have in my pocket.
Right.
And I'm going to now tell you what to do
right.
with your movie.
Right.
I feel like a fraud.
Right.
I feel like a total fraud. Like, okay, I believe in myself so much about what I'm going to do that I got paid up front and you don't get paid until it makes money.
Right.
I can't sit and have that meeting.
Especially that, for yeah. that. And that's why I was, Rob Zombie always talks about how he's like, yeah, I don't want to do a big $200 million movie because it's just too much. There's just too much at stake. There's too many people involved. I can't make the thing that I want. But it's sort of that like that Adult Swim model or that, you know, Louis C.K. FX model of like,
for sure.
Hey, yeah. we're going to empower the creators and the investment is comparatively lower. So it's okay. You know, like it's okay to take a risk on it.
Yeah.
And then what you get is really kind of unfiltered, point of view driven pieces.
Well, it's a little bit of a different point because we're saying two slightly different things. I think there's a different issue with when a movie requires $100 million X the above the line. You can't make a Marvel movie for a lot less than $100 million. And that's what it would make no sense. The
right.
audience wants to see a spectacle and they deliver a spectacle better than anybody else. And even if all the actors weren't making money, the movies would still be expensive.
Yeah.
So I think that leads to different problems because when you have to spend $100 million on a movie, regardless of the above the line, the storytelling has to have a broad appeal. And as soon as the storytelling has to have a broad appeal, some of us feel that it can often feel watered down.
Sure.
I think the hardest thing in the world, yeah. much harder than a low-budget movie, the hardest thing in the world is to make a movie for $200 million that feels edgy and unique
yeah.
and original.
Right. Yeah.
Like,
right.
that's really the hardest thing yeah. to
I
do.
Think that's why Guardians was such a
I agree.
An incredible, yeah. like, how did you
do this?
Yeah. yeah.
I totally agree.
Because we knew James could make a really cool, intimate movie.
Right.
But how do you scale that and maintain, you know,
and make it for four quadrants and please all the audience that,
right.
that you're being demanded to believe that you have to, as a responsible person, you must please them if you're spending that kind of money. How do you do that and make it edgy? That's really hard.
And by the way, I saw Happy Death Day and it's fucking great.
Oh, good.
You know,
oh,
I
good.
Wanted to be mad at it because Groundhog Day is my favorite movie. I'm like, it's horror Groundhog Day.
God
and then my
it.
Wife and I watch it and we're like, fuck, it's really good. God damn it. It's yeah. so well done.
That's great.
And it hasn't been.
I saw the trailer. I'm looking forward to
it. It's so good.
Friday the 13th, October, Friday the 13th.
Oh, fantastic.
There we go.
But
there's my plug.
But it, you know, what's great about it is that it has those perfect elements that a really great horror movie has, which is there's a mystery, you buy into the mechanism, and it's funny, and everyone in it's great, by the way. The lead actress is amazing. It's a really
She's terrific.
It's a really, really terrific movie.
Thank
and
you.
I hope that it makes as much money as I think it's gonna make because I want to see. Like that's a great horror movie.
Oh, thank you.
Top to bottom.
Thank you.
That's
a
very
free
to see.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, that's a movie that just checks every box of Blumhouse. And the first five boxes on the Blumhouse list and what built our company are the amazing artists that we work with. And that, you know, whether it's Scott Derrickson on Sinister or James Wan on Insidious or James DeMonaco on the Purge movies. And in this case, Chris Landon, I'd made four Paranormal Activity movies with him. I've known him for 10 years. He's the writer and director Jeez. Of Happy Death Day. And he is a super, super duper talented guy. And he was a little undervalued. And I've thrown him I've been trying. I call him. I'm always saying, what can we do? What can we do? What can he do? We finally landed on this. He's slightly undervalued. And I've gotten – the company is built on that too. James Wan had done Saw and then had done two movies that hadn't worked so well. And we bet on him. And that's happened over and over and over again because I believe a person's career is not just their last movie but their body of work. And if you look at my body of work, I've had plenty of misses too. You know what I mean? And you have to kind of look at the whole thing. Hollywood has a hard time doing that, which I understand why they do. But we kind of think about it differently. And Chris is just like – he did such a good job with the movie. And really, the movie is Chris's movie. You know, it was his vision, his writing, he really controlled all the creative aspects of the movie. And I'm so psyched about it. And hopefully, you'll do a lot more with him.
Yeah, I mean, it's just even all the characters were so great. Like, it's like, you know, I don't know what to compare it to, but you know, it's just like all the characters were really strong. They had their own identities, and they didn't just feel like incidental. Yeah. Like every character had a really strong point of view, and it was just really fun. The movie's super fun.
That's
and
great.
I think people are gonna dig it a lot.
Well, you and your wife understand, but if people look at horror movies cynically, always say like, what are the scares in the movie? But if you love horror movies, you know, like the scares are kind of the easy part. What makes the scares scary is the characters and the acting and the story. And I firmly believe you should be able to remove the scares from a horror movie, and that movie should be able to work on its own as a drama really well.
Right.
And I think when you have that, you have the making of a good horror movie. But that too is kind of antithetical to kind of reverse engineering scary movies. That happens a lot and usually results in not very good movies, I think.
Right. Well, but you know, I'm extra forgiving because we watch so many horror movies and I know how hard it is to make stuff.
Yeah, to make anything.
So, you know, even if we're watching something and it's like, oh, it's 30 minutes in and nothing's really happened yet, or you know, there aren't those kind of tentpole scares throughout the movie that sort of keep the momentum going. I go, you know, yeah, maybe they had a budget problem, or maybe they're
very kind.
You know, maybe someone didn't show up, or maybe something had to get cut out because we get so spoiled with our content now that when people watch something, they just think, oh, well, that's all there was. Everything I'm seeing is all there was. It's like, well, you don't know what was cut out. You don't know what problems they ran up against.
You should run a studio or be a producer, whatever. I mean, you are. But I think the biggest challenge, and I always tell this to the executives who work for me, the biggest challenge is we all see so much material, and you must read and watch looking for good, not bad.
Yeah.
You must. When we get new material, when we get a new script, when we're seeing a new movie, you have to look for what – it's so easy to be like, nah, 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 be bitchy about it. You have to look for what you're – the reason that people miss – you know, our company is built on scripts and movies that people have missed. The Purge, Paranormal Activity, The Visit, Unfriended. It goes – Get Out.
Oh, The Visit was great,
too. It goes on and on.
The Visit was great.
But all of those movies, whether we saw them as rough cuts or we read them as scripts, had been passed around and passed on. And they were passed on because you get worn down and you just say, this is nah, nah, nah. And I have amazing pass emails, which won't say from who, but on Get Out. Like Get Out. People who've passed on Get Out, which is kind of – which I should frame and put in my office. Mostly as a reminder, not as we're so great, but as a reminder of exactly what you said of like you have to look for the good and stuff before you look for the bad. I think it's really important.
I was so excited. Jordan did the podcast the day of the premiere, and I had seen it the night before.
Oh my God.
And I was saying to him, like, this movie is fucking like amazing. Like one of the best. It even transcends, even just calling it a horror movie is putting it too much in a box. And he said, oh, you know, that's where he kind of first talked about the idea of a social thriller. I'm like,
That's right.
Wow, a horror movie that actually has a real message. I mean, beyond the message of 80s horror films, which were oddly religious, like don't have premarital sex, you know, whatever, don't desecrate, you know, a church or whatever. But like a real messaging behind it that made it so special. And then seeing what happened with that movie, I was so excited for him and not surprised at all.
Yeah.
But I mean, it takes a real. You need someone like you in that position, and it's just why data alone doesn't hold water, because
it's the death of
studios running, like marketing divisions running studios and figuring out what demos and this and that. It's like you need a human voice to curate and see what's special and human about those specific stories. And I feel like it would have been so easy for something like Get Out to have been washed over by demographic programming or marketing.
Data is the death of quality. It really is. And another thing, just in fairness, it's which is tied to the low budgets. It makes me sound much smarter makes me sound much more of a rebel or an outlier than I am, because again, it's tied to low budgets. Like everyone is always like, low budget's so profitable. That's great. That's That's true. That's what keeps the lights on. And by the way, profit is very important to us, but it's not what's driving it. Low budgets keep us able to have the ability to say yes to Get Out. You know, that's what low budgets do. Low budgets keep our for our make it make me allow me to read something or look at something and say, hey, this is weird. It may not be commercial. I mean, how many ways wrong could Crime is Legal for 12 hours a year? Like, think of all the versions of that. Think of all the versions of that movie. It could have been horrible, right? And so I didn't read that saying, my God, this is going to – The Purge is going to be – but I read it saying, never seen it before.
Yeah.
It's weird. It feels like there's no comp to it. Let's make it because it's so cheap.
Right.
You know, as soon as we start playing in 80 million, 60, 80, 100 million, you can – I would never make – if I was running a studio and The Purge was sent to me and it was a $20 million movie, I would never make it in a million years. It would be crazy to make it.
Right.
So that's part – those things are really connected in our
company. But the other great thing too is that low budgets foster creativity because you have to problem solve.
Totally.
You know, once you're in a position where you can just throw money at stuff
– you get lazy.
You get lazy because you get – we'll just fix that. We'll just add that. Whatever. We'll shoot, you know.
You get lazy.
And when you don't have a lot of money and you don't have a lot of time to shoot and you don't have a – it's like, well, I guess we really need to figure out how to make this work. And that's what I think is really part of the magic of that genre is, you know, when you can figure out how to make it work. That's what makes it so special.
We were in prep on Get Out, and it was December 26th. I remember this, and we were going to shoot in California, and we lost the rebate. It was nobody's. It was no one's fault or anything. It was just we just lost the rebate, and we couldn't hit our number. And we were shooting in like 2 or 3 weeks, and we had to move the movie from shooting in L.A. to shooting in Alabama, and we were starting shooting in 15 days or something. Jeez. And I called Jordan on December – I think it was actually Christmas night. I think it was the night of Christmas.
Merry
I called
Christmas.
Jordan. I said, I have a Christmas present for you, or a Boxer's Day present is the next day. And I said, here's the situation. We lost the rebate, which, by the way, it was no one's fault except if it was any fault, it was my fault. It ain't his job to deal with the rebates. It's the producer and the production company. So as far as that – as far as Jordan's concerned, like, it's my fault. And not only is it my fault, but you're going to have to pay for it because we can't shoot in California anymore. So we're going to have to move to Alabama. And, you know, he didn't raise his voice. He was never angry at me. He said, okay. He said, let me think about it for a day and I'm going to call you back and we're going to figure out how we do this. He called me the next day and he said, I know how we can do it. And we're going to scout. They started scouting immediately. We moved the whole production. I think the movie is way better as a result. Again, it was a bad mess up on our part, but to be nimble and to be able to think that way, I totally agree with you that it makes for better entertainment. It doesn't necessarily make for an easier process.
No.
It's certainly a lot harder to do with less money, but I think it makes for a better result.
But also it really underscores the idea of what makes a successful person or what makes something successful is, you know, there will never be any end to the hurdles or the stonewalling or anything. Yeah. But when people, you know, even if you get pissed for a minute, the people who go, okay – and ask the good questions of how could we make this work?
Right.
As opposed to saying, like, this fucking sucks. Everything sucks. Of course this happened to me.
Yeah.
It's fucking Eugene Grace all over again. You know, it's like it's asking those questions of, like, how do we solve these problems?
Yeah.
And, because honestly, this idea that I keep coming back to is I keep saying to people is, like, there's no artistry in perfection. It's like the best things, the things with the most personality are unique and have flaws, and it's figuring out how to bake those in and make it work. And that's where the really special stuff comes from.
100%. Yeah. And again, I think it's all tied to being able to take chances, and the way you do that is by not spending a lot of money.
Right.
Is there something too, like, you know, you have The Purge, which is like, you know, is going to be in theaters when you're making it.
No, and not true. We don't make any of our movies like that.
Okay.
Only sequels. So every time we do a sequel, we know we have a release date and we know it's going to be in theaters. Originals, no, because that would take away what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah.
Because if you made an original movie and it doesn't matter if you're spending the money on the budget or the marketing, it's still spending money. So if we made The Purge, the first Purge was $2.8 million, and we had a release date with the studio, that's a $30 million thing.
Yeah.
So the decision for the studio, it's not a $3 million, it's a $33 million decision. Doesn't matter. So I don't want a release when I make an original movie. It's part of the whole way we maintain independence and freedom is – there's no pressure on the studio to decide if they're going to release the movie or not until the movie is finished. If we force them to say you have to do a wide release before we started, that would force them to, again, have to make take away a lot of the chances that we take by not having that commitment up front.
And go ahead, Joe. Well, so then a movie like Creep, which has a sequel coming out soon.
Yeah, Creep 2.
Yeah. Is
Creep again.
Oh, is that Duplass? The Duplass?
Yes. Yeah.
With Patrick Bryce.
Right.
And so it was like, is Creep 2 going to have a theatrical
run?
No.
So Creep, same thing. When I first saw, I think it was a 20-minute version or a 50-minute version of Creep, and I wanted a wide release for the first Creep.
Yeah.
When the movie was finished and we all watched it together, there are plenty of times I've tried to get a wide release and haven't succeeded.
Yeah.
On that movie, we all kind of agreed, I think it's better suited for, it was Netflix at the time. I think actually that's not true. We screened the movie at South by Southwest. We didn't get an offer for a wide release. I didn't push a wide release in the movie because I felt like the movie is a little too quirky to have a 3,000 screen release. But then we got a great, terrific deal from Netflix, and we're making the next one, and everyone made a little bit of money. And that's we do that a lot. We did this. Mike Flanagan is an amazing filmmaker, and he did the second Ouija movie for us, which I thought was excellent. He did a movie for us called Hush. Mm. Hush.
Yeah, I remember Hush.
Hush. In my bones, should have been a wide release movie, and there were certain circumstances around the market and certain other things, and I couldn't get a wide release for it. I just couldn't do it. But that's a movie I tried. Yeah. I couldn't do it. We sold it to Netflix, and Netflix now, they took Mike Flanagan forever. He's making 500 things for Netflix, but so it did very well for them.
Creep's like 78 minutes long or something. It's pretty short.
So most of our movies about 81.
But you know what's great about that, though?
Cheap means a short movie. There's not a lot on the editing floor. What we shot is what you saw is what we shot.
When you'd have to go to the video store, and you go to the video store, that was sort of a weird understood metric that if a movie was under 90 minutes, you go, I don't know if this is going to be that great. But it doesn't mean that anymore. Yeah. And what I loved about Creep is it's like, well, that's how long it took to tell the story. It was as long as it needed to be, which was about 78 minutes.
Well, the fun thing about digital platforms is you can have a 78-minute movie. When we have a theatrical movie, there's still international television deals require a minimum length of 81 minutes. Now, that includes credits. So you could have a 75-minute movie and a long credit sequence. And by the way, we've had quite a few of those. But you still have to hit that 81-minute mark when you're going a traditional theatrical release. But on digital, if it's an Amazon or Netflix or all those, it doesn't matter, which is fun.
At what point in the process does the studio decide they're going to get behind it and send it out for release?
So the way we do it is we make the movie, kind of off the grid, and then I usually test the movie with the filmmaker without the studio. 99 times out of 100 at that point, we're kind of all on the same page. And I'll call up the studio and say, hey, listen, we hope every movie that we make at a certain – we make – $3 million movies, and that's different. But every movie that we make at a $4 to $5 million zone, we are going for a wide release. That's what we want. We don't always get there. So I finish the movie. We screen it with the director. And like I said, 99 times out of 100, I'll say to the director, you got it here, and I'm going to work with the studio and try and get them to confirm this. Or I'll say, you know what? This is quirkier than we all thought. It doesn't feel that mainstream, and it's better suited to 10 screens or 100 screens or Netflix or whatever. And we have that conversation then. So it's actually never contentious with the studio for this other reason, which is, so then if I think it's wide release, call up my partners at Universal. We screen the movie for them, and we've agreed every single time. We've done 24 movies, 24 wide releases together. We've agreed every single time except once. So if I don't agree with Universal, so in 5 years I haven't agreed one time, right? So if I don't agree with Universal, I don't know if it's contractual or not, but they're kind enough to say, if you think it's a wide release and we don't, show it to other people. And we'll let it go, and we'll let someone else, which is a terrific thing.
Wow.
So on this one movie, I said, it's a wide release. You guys are wrong. I'm gonna use my clause or whatever. Again, I don't even know if it's a clause or not, but we have a very easy relationship. And I showed it to 10 other all the theatrical distributors. they all passed.
Oh, no.
So I had to go back to Universal and say, well, the other 10 studios agree with you, too. And sorry about that.
Well, I was just kidding about that before.
Yeah.
Did you think I was serious?
I wasn't that passionate about it. I just made calls like a crazy person for the last 2 weeks.
Are you doing Halloween with Danny McBride? Is that you?
I'm so excited.
What?
And David Gordon Green.
David Gordon Green's directing. David and Danny wrote it.
That's insane.
And it's going to come out next October.
God damn it.
Is it already shot?
I think they're shooting at the end of the year. I think
Danny John Carpenter's involved.
John Carpenter's executive. No. He's executive producing. Not tangential.
That's crazy.
No, he was the key for me, for us to do it. I was very, very important to me that that he do it. It's kind of a funny story, and there were obviously there's Malick and Trankus, and the company Trankus has produced every Halloween movie, and they just Halloween is their whole thing, and they were kind enough to kind of let us partner with them, which was great. And then Miramax owns the rights. Also, because Dimension had distributed a long time. It doesn't matter. Anyway, I said to Miramax and I said to Malick, I said, look, I'm so flattered. I would love to do this, but I really don't want to do it without John. It just doesn't feel right. And they said, we agree. You know, we tried to get John. We tried to get him on board, but we couldn't do it. And I said, well, let me give it a shot. And I had the most hilarious meeting with John Carpenter. I'd never met him before. And I went over to his office and I sat with him. My meeting started at 3 o'clock and I got there like 3:01. And I walked out at 3:15. And it was 15 minutes long. He was super nice, but it was very to the point. You know what I mean? And it was very to the point. And I didn't know. I just had no idea. It wasn't bad, but I just didn't know. And I called his agent who set up the meeting. And she said, it's over. I said, yeah, it's over. She said, well, he's very quick, which I am too, but not that quick.
Right.
And anyway, I said, I have no idea. Anyway, 15 minutes later. We must have been. I don't know what it was. Something in the tea. But
sounds like he's on a 15-minute cycle.
He said, "I do it." He's on a 15-minute cycle.
Every
30 minutes
minutes
later, yeah. He's on a 15-minute cycle. But anyway, crazy. Then he agreed to come on as an executive producer, and it's been very, very fun actually working with him and his wife, and terrific.
That's fantastic.
And I think he's going to do the music for the
movie. I was just about to ask that.
Yeah. We're almost. I think the deal's not quite done, but we're going to make it. And he's got. We can't.
You have to do the music.
No. He's gonna compose new music.
Yeah,
that's what you meant.
Yeah. No, because exactly. That's what I was talking. Because that's what he's been mainly focusing on.
Yes, totally.
Yeah, totally.
Oh, that's so fantastic.
Rad. Yeah,
I think one of the greatest jokes in movies in the last decade is in Baby Driver when he goes, "Hey, everyone, put on Michael Myers masks," and they show up with Austin Powers. This Mike Myers.
Yeah.
No, not that guy.
Yeah.
No.
I told you to get Halloween masks. These are Halloween masks. No, Mike Myers. This is Mike Myers.
the guy in the mask. Yeah. What was it? Jason.
Oh, Jason.
No, that's right.
I'd love to make a movie.
And you guys are doing a Universal horror.
We're doing this thing, which I've been trying to do for a long time. Which we've done over the years. We've done a movie here and there with John Murdy, who runs Universal Horror Nights, who's a great, amazing horror loving guy. And I've always wanted to do the Blumhouse of Horrors. The Horrors of Blumhouse, technically, is the name. And so we have four. We have Insidious. We have Happy Death Day. We have Sinister, and we have The Purge.
Yeah.
Are all in a Blumhouse of Horrors.
That's so great.
Well, they do
in
the
this
Purge.
One thing. Which
we go every year. They did Purge last year.
Yeah, they did.
Where you walk by the airplane crash.
In that scare zone. Yes.
Yeah, that's fucking great.
Yeah.
I mean, and the thing that is crazy to me is that we're recording this in September 12th. In 3 days, Halloween Horror Night starts.
It's already starting?
I'm going. Yeah. Friday, opening night. I'm going.
The only reason I'm not going is because I'm going to Hall & Oates.
Oh, Hall & Oates?
Hall & Oates for Fears.
Hall & Oates and Tears for Fears are playing at Staples Center.
Staples. How fun.
I'm so good.
I love Hall & Oates.
I know.
Oh.
And I'm bummed that I'm going to miss horror. I mean, we're still going to go to Horror Night.
Just not opening night.
We're just not going to go to the opening night.
Yeah. I was there yesterday checking everything out. It looks really cool.
So do you have all the – those are all set up this year, Happy Death Day and
– All this year, and it's called The Horrors of Blumhouse. One of the mazes is The Horrors of Blumhouse, and it has three movies in it. The Insidious – the fourth Insidious movie comes out at the beginning of January. There's a separate Insidious maze, but The Horrors of Blumhouse has The Purge, Sinister – and Happy Happy Death Day, yeah. all in one thing.
It's like a good lineup of mazes this year. It was almost like it felt like a festival being announced, because it's like, you know, there was like the Horrors of Blumhouse, Ash vs. Evil Dead. It was like, look at this lineup.
Look at these guys. This is great.
We did a live event about 6 years ago called the Blumhouse of Horrors in downtown LA, which was great and a lot of fun. And over the years, over in October, we've done various live events, successfully losing money every single time. but they're very fun. Very hard to make money in a live event, but they're a lot of fun.
Oh man, we should have you. It's probably too expensive and too lawyery. But I made a music comedy Comic-Con festival this year in Northern California at the Shoreline Amphitheater. We're going to do it again next year. We should totally have a haunted house there, like a Blumhouse haunted house there.
Well, we could do it. No, legally, it's not hard.
Kids at a festival would love it too, because it's hot outside and sunny. You go inside the house, you get in the shade. It's going to be a long line for that.
That'd be great. So much fun.
Where is it in Northern California?
At the Shoreline Amphitheater. It's at Silicon Valley in Mountain View.
Oh, very cool.
And it's a music festival at night and a comedy festival in the afternoon, but the whole daytime stuff is a Comic-Con, so it's all Comic-Con programmed in the middle of it.
That'd be
so much fun.
Awesome.
This is, you know, what would you say how would you describe your job, like, now that you've been doing this for a while? Because the amount of projects you have going on simultaneously, and people say I'm busy, but I look at everything that Blumhouse puts out, and then you have separate sub studios within Blumhouse. Yeah. How do you fucking run all of that? How do you scale but still maintain the personal quality which is a very difficult thing to do when you're scaling up?
Yeah.
Is not diluting the voice and making sure that you're still involved in all of it.
Well, I think about that every second of every day. For me, the most fun I have doing what I do is the building part. It's so interesting. It's so hard. Not hard in woe is me, but it's a challenge that I love, because it keeps my brain buzzing all the time. I really fundamentally believe in delegating. So I really have – most of the people who've worked at the company have worked there a long time. I really believe in we had one wonderful exception with the people who run the television company. But generally, the senior executives have been grown up started as assistants. So they really understand the DNA of the company. And I really – and again, you know, it sounds like a low-budget nut, but I am a low-budget nut. And I guess that's – you know, again, it's like, if someone who I've worked with for a long time and who I know and who I believe in and who I really understand, and they're coming in saying, I can't live if we don't do this, they're inexpensive, so we do it.
Right.
You know, and if that person makes – 4 wrong bets, they don't work at the company anymore.
Sure,
right?
sure.
But everyone gets a few misses, including myself. And so a big way that I do it is delegating. I'm super careful about my time. I'm sure, like, you are too.
Sure.
You know, I really watch my time. I've got a young daughter too, so that's very important to me, that I juggle my family time too. But the challenge of that is really one of the things that drive me. Where am I? You have to check your ego, like you were saying. I just read this great book called Ego is the Enemy. Have you heard of that book?
No, but I gotta read it.
It came out. It's very good. I mean, it's a good book. It's not a great book, but it was interesting for me. And you have to kind of put your ego aside and say, what am I really needed for, right? Where am I really needed? More often I spend time on the projects that aren't going well than the ones that are, mm-hmm. right? It's because those are the ones that need extra attention. But I'm very, very aware of what I'm doing and how I'm spending my time all day long. And if my office, you know, my assistants, if you were talking to them, they would say probably get cranky about a lot. But the thing that I get most cranky about is when my time is messed up or wasted.
Sure.
Because
it just unseats everything in the day. It has this weird domino effect of, like, then you're late for that, and then it just carries out throughout the rest of the day.
It messes everything up. We have, you know, Cooper Samuelson, who runs the movie business, has been there a long, long time, the production side, and Charles Layton, who's kind of the business partner and helps build everything. So it's a great team. And then the team I was talking about in TV is Jeremy and Marcy, Marcy Wiseman and Jeremy Gold, who are senior television executives who I've spent a long time with. And it was funny, I was meeting with them this morning and they were running through the TV slate and they started justifying a decision. And I interrupted Marcy or Jeremy at the time. I said, don't justify it. I said, I get it. You did this. You understand why? Move on. And so all those things helped me. But that's the... that's the challenge that I live every day. And you know, so far it's going great. But where I see the company and eventually and where it is now are very different. And whether I get there or not remains to be seen.
What is it that you want to do?
I'd like to our television company is not nearly as mature as our movie company. So I'd really like to get the TV business up to the movie business. We have a little very nascent distribution company called Tilt, which is hit a few singles at best. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to really figure that part out. Again, in terms of talking to a distribution executive, if I do it too and I don't, and I'm not doing it well, it's hard to look them in the eye and say, I think you should do this and do that, right? Yeah. We're playing with distribution in a relatively inexpensive way. So we keep taking shots. So I'd like to get that propped up. Eventually, I always make a joke, and this I mean, it's not really a joke, but it's a dream that may or may not happen, depending not on what we do, but kind of on outside forces. But I do feel like it would be cool to have an argument about, like, let's say the reboot of Paranormal Activity we're making in 8 years. And it's like there's half the room saying we should open that on, like, if there's a Blumhouse channel on Apple TV or whatever, and half the room is saying we should go theatrically, and the Blumhouse channel wins. Now, we're nowhere near that right now, but that's something that I think about in the future, and it's interesting.
I mean, a Blumhouse channel makes a lot of sense because I just assume that coming up with event-style movies that people actually leave their house for and go park and get out and deal with other people on their phones in the fucking theater. I mean, it seems like more and more there are less reasons for people to leave their house, and it's harder and harder and harder to get people to go to a movie theater. So, and really, when you have that much of a body of work, you're essentially like a network in a way.
Yeah.
People know what the brand is, so why not? I mean, I think it makes a lot of – especially in when who fucking knows what's going to be in 8 years.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Who knows?
There won't even be movies. You'll just scan an app in front of your eyes, and you'll just have the experience of having seen recall. Something.
Oh, yes, exactly. Yeah. A movie will take 1 minute.
Yeah. Instead of having to go to Recall Industries, it's just an app. It just flashes. Exactly. Like, oh, that was great.
I saw that movie. It took a minute to watch.
I mean, I definitely, you know, I'm sure there's some sort of – I'm sure there's some technology that they're talking about at the Kurzweil at Singularity University where they're like, oh, they'll just flash something in your – and then you'll just get the subconscious experience of whatever that thing was.
Yeah.
But getting people to experience things is, you know, who knows where that's going to be in 8 years. That's why it's so hard to go, well, here's what we're going to do, because you just – it's impossible to know where everything's going to go at that point.
No.
But when you're watching something – if you come in, or you're – whether something is done or whether you come in to put out fires – what are the essential questions that you're asking to try to fix it or make sure that it stays on track? What is it that you are trying to feel that it like we're on the right track now?
I find so often it's a communication issue. Like people are scared to talk to this. I'm very direct, as you could tell. I'm very direct. I'm very direct with the directors. I'm very direct with the talent. That's part of the thing of, like, when you sit down and we talk about making your movie, I'm like, it's either going to get released on 3,000 screens, 100 screens, or on fucking Netflix.
Right.
You know, that's it. Like, that's the deal that you're making. And I'm very, very clear and direct all the way through the process. And for me, usually when it goes off track, it's someone's trying to protect someone else's feelings and the message gets all muddled. And so more often than not, I call the director, I call the other producer, I call the actor. I just dive in, and I learned that from my mother, you know, and I have to say she taught me very well in that regard. It's like, if you have something to go, you know, you just face it and deal with it and deal with the consequences of it. And I really, the longer that I do this, I believe that more and more. And if you have bad news for someone, give them the bad news quickly. Give it to them first. Don't hold it back.
Oh, yeah.
And usually that's more often than not, that's what it is. It's a communications issue.
But what about from a story perspective? Like, if you're watching something and it's not working – what is it that you are what are some of the broader questions that you're asking to try to make to keep a story in line?
A movie?
Yeah, if you watch it and you go, I don't know, something's missing. Like, what is it that you – I know it's not just one thing, the same thing every time, but what are some of the fundamental questions?
Well, the fundamental thing I do, which – you know, and Get Out is a great example of this. We tested Get Out. Almost all my directors, and if it's not the director, it's another producer, have Final Cut. Because I don't believe you can ask someone to work for free and bet on themselves and then say, you have to, you only get paid if your movie works, but I'm gonna, I have the right to force you to do what I want you to do.
Because then it's not their point of view, it's your point of view.
No, no. Right. So our directors have final cut. Now, I found when you relinquish creative control to your directors, they want our input more than anything else because they don't have to do it. So they're smart. What do you think of this? What do you think of this? Casting, this, that, everything else. Jordan had final cut on Get Out. And we screened the movie, and at the end of the movie, the lead character winds up in jail. And the everyone's loving the movie, but then at the end, the cops, it's not the security guard, the cops pull up, they see a black guy on a dead white girl, and they throw him in jail. There's a scene with him in jail.
Oh,
and
shit.
Yeah, that's the end of the movie.
The audience is super bummed.
The audience is a super bummed. It's like one of the great things about the movie is that no matter what color, breed, or kind of human being you are, you love that guy at the end of the movie. You love him. And you can't – and the movie on, I was like – I couldn't even hold myself back. I said, Jordan, you cannot put him in jail. You cannot do this. And all these people around me looked at me like, what are you saying? Like, why would you say that? Like, what are you saying now? And it just kind of bubbled out of me. And Jordan, again, to his credit, and because he acts exactly like you described, a great – you know, didn't be like, Blum, this asshole is trying to make a happy ending on my movie. He was like, let me think about it. And he came up with a brilliant, inspired end to the movie. And it's a long way to answer your question. But what I like to do is point out a problem that I have and tell the filmmaker why I have the problem, but not try and solve it for them. One of my greatest strengths as someone who runs this company is that I do not want to be a writer and I do not want to be a director. And I would be a terrible Definitely a terrible writer and the worst director. I would just be so bad at it. And I'm not frustrated about that. I look at the director on set and I say, thank God that is not me. I don't want to be that person. And that's a great benefit as a producer. It's a huge benefit to me. I don't want to do that job and I wouldn't be good at that job. But I am good at saying, looking at a television show or a movie or a script and saying, this is not working for me. Here's why it's not working. It doesn't make me feel good. I fell in love with this lead character. Now you're putting him in jail. I feel like you cheated me. You can't do that. And letting the director work with us. We had a lot of conversations with Joel Edgerton. We did The Gift. And when we did The Gift, we couldn't get the ending right.
Another great movie.
Terrific movie. Joel did such a good job on that movie. And another movie, by the way, that everyone passed on for 3 years. And then The Gift was in the same category. And everyone passed on the script. And there was a big, big conversation about the end. In that movie, Joel held his – I wanted it to be much more – black and white, and Joel wanted it to be gray, very gray, and we wound up in the middle, and the middle was right. Joel was right. Joel was right to push back, and I'm glad he didn't do exactly what I wanted to do, but there's that too. You have to be comfortable realizing when you're going into it that I have to be comfortable that I may not get my way. You know,
right.
I have, when you give the director final cut, they have final cut.
Right.
So there's a version where Jordan could have said, you know what, Jason? I love you. I disagree. And I want this guy in jail. And that's going to be the movie. And then I have to be at peace with that.
Right.
It doesn't mean I don't pull my hair out, but I have to live with that.
But it is really important to empower the creators because, you know, I think if you're going to hire someone and entrust them to do something and carry out their creative vision, then it doesn't really imbue them with the trust if you go, but do it this way. That's not at all. Then why hire that person?
Yeah, exactly.
Why just?
They gotta have confidence to do exactly what they were aiming to do in the first place.
Yeah.
If they start to second guess themselves, they'll start to chip away at it.
And again, you know, giving final cut when the movies are inexpensive is a lot easier than giving it when the movies are expensive.
Yeah. So I'm such a horror fan. I think I'm gonna try to make a horror movie. And
we're producing it.
What?
We're making it. What do you mean? Do you have a script?
Well, I'm just starting to write a script with someone.
Are you kidding?
No. I'm serious.
I mean, you waited till the end of the interview to bring this up? This should have been the opening thing. My God.
I was about to ask you.
Are you going to direct it?
I was thinking about it.
You should direct it.
I never thought I wanted to direct, but
you have to
every
direct
time
it.
I see Jordan Peele, he goes, "You should direct." And I go, "I don't think I could." And he goes, "No, you should.
We agree. You can direct it."
But I brought it up because I was going to ask you, like, should I go down this path of trying to
totally? And we're going to help you.
Okay.
when is my script ready?
Born on the Nerdist
when
podcast.
When is my script ready? And are you allowed to say who your writing partner is?
I'll say, and then if she's not cool with it, then I'll cut it out. Yeah, but yeah. It's Heather Ann Campbell.
Oh, she's awesome.
Who is that? Heather is a brilliant writer performer. She's actually on Whose Line Is It Anyway all the time, but she's also.
I know who that is.
She's
I know who
a
that
fucking
is.
Brilliant.
Who that is. Yes.
And
yes,
also
yes, yes, yes.
A horror fanatic and an anime fanatic, and just like the yeah, fucking one of the smartest
we're
people.
We're making
I know.
The movie, goddammit.
Okay.
Send me that script.
Okay. Well, we got to write it, but we have the concept.
Okay,
it was her
okay.
concept.
That's great.
And I said, let's just fucking make a horror movie. That's and she great. Was like, yeah, let's do it.
That's great.
But
the Purge, in a way, you know, kind of everyone talked about Get Out as when Get Out was much more overt, but The Purge is really about and the James and his wife and his young daughter live in Staten Island, and James is a very very interested in civic duty and community, and you know is very political, and James was very upset, like everyone was upset with the school shooting in Connecticut. And I think then a lot of people were also even more upset about the idea that one of the responses to the school shooting in Connecticut or school shootings generally is to put a guard in a school with a gun. And that just seems like so wrong-headed. Like before you get rid of guns, instead of getting rid of guns, you're going to put a guard in a school with a gun. Really?
Yeah.
And so The Purge was really the first purge, and now it's become more about class and race. But the first purge was really about like, if you're going to do that, let's make crime. What about we just let crime? Well, let crime be legal 12 hours a year. And what about poor people shoot each other so there is no more unemployment,
right.
And there are no more poor people? You know, and that. That was very much understood in Europe. In France, The Purge is called America's Nightmare. That's the literal translation. That's what it is. That's it. That's it. I have the poster, America's Nightmare. America's Nightmare. But you know, in America, some people got that, and some people thought it was just a silly horror movie, and some people thought it was like a revenge, like The Purge is a great idea. Those people I was worried about. Yeah. I bringing this up. But there's a great, you know, scary movie is such a fun skin to put a family drama in or a social thriller in. You know, this is a long way of saying I cannot wait to read the script. And it's a great genre, especially if you know so much about it or such a fan. It's a great way to play around with all these other themes.
But I'm also excited to try the idea of like, you know, when we watch stuff, it's so easy to armchair critic and go, oh, they should have done this or they should have done that. And like I said, I am very forgiving, but I'm so fascinated to see what the process is to see like, oh, motherfucker, it's not, you know, it's not
it's tough.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sinister. The reason Ethan doesn't like horror movies and Ethan did Sinister, and now I've converted him completely, but he really didn't like them. And he read Sinister and
he's
he read what well, I love him. He's, you know, very, very good friends. We've done a lot of movies together. And he said, and what he saw was a Sundance movie about a guy who's married and has two kids and, chooses his career over his family, right? He endangers his family by moving into a house that he moves into because he needs a new hit. He's had a hit novel 10 years ago. Yeah. He did his In Cold Blood. He wants to write another hit. He wants to write another hit book. And the way to write a hit book is to move into this house, and he endangers his family by doing it. And really for him, it was a movie about choosing your career over your family or the struggle that people have with that. And I think that is another – it doesn't have to be gun control or race. You know, it can be that too. It can be a quiet theme.
But that's about making it about – you know, when Jon Stewart was doing The Daily Show, he had this – he didn't say this on The Daily Show, but he would say when, you know, in developing other projects, he would say, you know, make it about something.
Yes.
And so when a horror movie isn't just – I mean, there are some that are really funny. It's like, you know, Devil's Rejects is great because it's just like, oh, they just go on a killing spree.
It's a bloodbath.
And that's what that is.
Yeah.
But for the most part, like when something is about something, is like there's really some substance to it,
that's when it really comes alive, and you come away from it going, fuck, I feel like you feel exhilarated.
Yeah.
Because horror is like animation in the sense that you can convey ideas that you couldn't just come out and say because there's a level of separation.
100%.
You know, and that sort of, or even sci-fi in that Roddenberry way of like, yeah, I'm going to tackle social issues.
100%.
Or, you know, oh, by the way, I don't know if you ever saw, do you watch Rick and Morty? Rick and Morty is probably the best show on television, and they did a fucking phenomenal Purge episode.
Oh, I did see that. James said that to me.
Yes.
That's why it sounding familiar. Yes. James said it to me, which was incredible.
Yes.
Incredible, incredible, incredible. Yeah, James sent that
but it,
to
isn't
me.
It kind
it's
of,
amazing.
It is kind of amazing. Interesting that so many of these things that you've been involved with have just become conventions. Like,
yeah,
a Purge
cool.
is like a – you know, that's sort of like, oh, we're going to do a purging. It's almost a verb. Or found footage, you know, like doing – you know, like really exploring that – Do you think there's any space left in found footage?
No, I mean, I hope not. Jesus. I mean, unfortunately,
is
yes.
Creep 2 going to be? Because technically,
yes,
Creep, was found
Creep 2 is found footage. I mean, Creep 2 is actually a good example. I think the only time, to do a movie in found footage is if the story makes no sense unless it's found footage.
That's a great way to think about it.
So if you can do it in any other way, don't do found footage. If the story yeah. only makes sense by doing it as a found footage story, then of course that's how you have to do it. But it's just so tired.
Well, there is. And also you get halfway into a found footage movie and you go, why wouldn't you fucking put the camera down?
No shit, that's the hardest thing we had. We made 6 Paranormal Activity movies.
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah.
Are you kidding? We wanted to blow our brains out. It's like, wait, you know how many times we had this conversation? You're dying. Why is he holding the camera? We had that conversation for 6 years.
Yeah.
6 years. Yeah. It's impossible. It makes sucks. No sense that horror movies are found footage. It makes no sense. We went to the greatest lengths to justify the camera. Remember we had the, in Paranormals, we started the pinwheel of security cameras?
Yep.
That's why we started security cameras, because you don't – at the time, the thing that the viewer wants to see, the action, you can never justify keeping a camera on.
Yeah, I thought
and
Bobcat –
so we went crazy.
Bobcat did a pretty good version of his Willow Creek.
Willow Creek.
Willow Creek. But it's because a guy desperately wants to capture –
the, yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah. The conceit has to be the conceit of the movie has to be. I mean, that was the great thing that Oren did with Paranormal. The conceit of the movie is, I'm going to fucking show you that you're nuts,
yeah.
and I'm going to show you that you cannot film a ghost.
Yeah,
you know
yeah,
what
yeah.
I mean? Or prove that a ghost exists or doesn't exist. But there'll be another found footage. I mean, the new found footage maybe is vertical movies, you know, because that's where you look on your phone. Like
right.
Something. There'll be a new version of it.
Right.
So new theaters will be built.
I know. The screen will
portrait
like,
mode.
Well, what are they
would you like
do?
To see this
I
movie
mean,
in portrait
right,
or landscape
know,
in the fucking screen?
I feel like
screen.
That might happen.
Over.
I don't know.
That you know, that's not a terrible – I mean,
it is a terrible idea.
It'd be really frustrating to watch – because it'd be like watching a portrait version of a video on Facebook, but in a movie theater where the whole time you're
but
like,
if it were
turn
huge?
The fucking camera, turn it this way.
But that's because I mean you're much younger than I am. But if you
not
grew
that much
up,
younger.
If you grew up watching like this, you would maybe go to a movie theater. It's more natural to see.
You might,
you absolutely might. Yeah.
So as we're wrapping this up, people should absolutely see Happy Death Day Friday, October 13th.
Thank you.
They should go to Horror Nights. And
yes, they
see
should.
Blumhouse Land.
Blumhouse of Horrors.
House
and
of Horrors.
Some of the guys you work with that do the Shockwave podcast, Shock Value.
Oh yes.
They did a thing called Slashback Video. In Burbank, which is they recreated a old 80s video store.
Oh, I saw that on your Instagram.
Okay. Yeah. It's actually wearing the pin right now. But like, it's like if you're a fan of horror and stuff like that, it's in Burbank at the Bearded Lady.
And while we're plugging, go to Crypt TV, run by Jack Davis, which is short form scary stuff online. We're partners with him in Crypt TV.
Oh, fantastic!
Which is really really cool.
Fantastic.
That's our, those are our digital efforts. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Thank you, 360 plug. I appreciate it.
That's great. You know, it's been so much fun talking to you, and I really
super fun.
Appreciate it. And
I can't wait to read the script when it's written
when it's written. Well, you probably come in and tell you the idea first before, so you're like, this is terrible, get
you
out
can
of
do
my
that
office
too. You
get
can
out
do
of
that
my
too.
Office
you can do that
but,
too.
But okay, so those are all the plug things, and thank you for being here.
Awesome. Thank
this
you
it's an absolute pleasure.
Thank you. Super fun. Thank you.
Enjoy
thank
your
thank
burrito
you
everyone.
Thank you.
Now leaving nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.